time for Hype and Nonsense. As live as they want to be from California, here's Sean and Jen.
Yep, live as we're not really at all live from California. The state that is drying up as we speak. Mandatory water things are happening. I don't even know about it. I just like to run all my faucets during the day for no reason. We got them. Welcome to Hyper Nonsense. We are the podcast that comes to you straight from the heart of California. And if you haven't worked it out already, sorry to say Jen is not here. But before you hit the next button, before you run away in sheer terror, I have a special, not even a guest. We're actually upgrading him from guest to guest co-host, I think would be the official title. I'll check with the management office when I fill out the TPS reports later. But anyway, let's welcome to the show Mr. Colin from the United Kingdom. Can you say hello, Colin?
Hello, Colin.
All right. You're here. We did it all. Yes. We did it all. We did the intro. I got all the buttons pushed in the right orders. It's amazing. Colin, you're in the United Kingdom, right? Still?
Yep.
You didn't move to some other place?
No, I'm still here in Bath in the southwest of England. And I haven't talked to you or been on your show, or you've been on my show for, what, a couple of years now?
Yeah, it's been a really long time. Because what happened is we were actually planning on having you on. Man, it was back in, 2013-ish, I think. And then we were like, oh yeah, we're going to do it. We're going to totally do it. And then we decided to break everything again. And we were off for a little while, but we're back now. We're doing a make good, you know, our pledge in the year 2015 on Hyper Nonsense is we want to try to have one guest on per month. And if things continue on as they have with Jen, I don't know, this may become a podcast that's done by committee. And just to get everybody kind of caught up with that. Yeah, no, that's totally fine. Because what's going on is that we're having an extreme allergy season. And of course, Jen, has just about every allergy known to science at this point. And the pollen counts have just been absurd. I mean, they've been in excess. Like, you know, I think a normal pollen count is, you know, maybe around like a 5 or a 6. And they've been in excess of 10 for weeks every day. So she's kind of taken to sleeping through the highest pollen count parts of the day, which includes right now. We're recording at almost 8 p.m. Pacific time. So, you know, if you think of, you know, it's kind of normal for people to have, we'll just say, 8 hours of sleep. Jen's kind of swung her sleep all the way to now where she's sleeping anywhere between like 1 p.m. and 2 a.m., depending. So I just knew that there was no point for me to try and wake her up for this show. But it doesn't matter because we have Colin.
Yeah. And it's 8 p.m. Pacific time. It's, 3:58 in the morning in the UK.
Yeah,
but now I too have been having some messed up sleep patterns.
Well, you know, I remember when we've done shows with you in the past that, you know, you were always, you know, it was never that unusual for us to do a show, you know, kind of evening time for us and for you to still be awake. So I don't know, you know, do you attribute this to anything? Are you having seasonal allergy issues? Are you being attacked by pollen?
Not. I'm not, but actually,
Okay.
one of my dogs is allergic or has sort of hay fever or whatever, so he's been suffering recently.
Okay.
And the other dog is currently sleeping on the bed next to me, and there's a reasonable chance he'll start complaining at some point during this recording.
Yeah.
But yeah, well, basically, it's nothing to do with allergies as far as I'm concerned. It's just the fact that, I sort of have dinner with the family, watch TV, whatever. And then when I come upstairs to my room, I start doing stuff on the computer. And I carry on doing stuff on the computer, and I carry on doing stuff on the computer, and suddenly it's 6 o'clock in the morning. And
Yeah.
I sleep during the morning, get up at sort of in the afternoon, and deal with the family. And then the whole cycle starts again. But it's been particularly bad recently because I've been doing, other stuff. So, I mean, what, today I woke up at about 8:30 in the evening our time. So,
Wow.
yeah, it's been quite messy recently, but
That reminds me
that's,
of back when I first got the internet at home. This was September of 96, and I'd gotten a new computer, a shiny Pentium 75, everybody, with what did I get? 8 megabytes, I think. 8 megabytes of RAM. I almost said 8 gigabytes, but that would have been unthinkable. Eight megs of RAM. And I remember when I upgraded it to 16, I thought, oh man, I'm killing it over here with my P75. And I'd gotten my dad that came with a 14.4 speed modem, 14.4 kilobit. Was that I think it was 14.4. 14.4, so basically a 1400 baud modem. And I got my dad to install a second phone line in the house. And I paid for it all, but we had to we got the phone company to bring the line up to the house, and then we had to punch a hole in the wall, put in a jack, run this ridiculously long cable. It was like a really like ugly DIY thing, but we managed to get it to work, got that all hooked up. And like the first night when I had, my own internet connection, and I'd only used the internet like maybe a couple times before that ever in my life. And I just remember going online, and then I was up. It like completely changed everything for me. I would just every night from then on, I would just go on the computer. Starting around like maybe 9, 10 o'clock. And that was officially when I became like a real night person. Because that's when I was on a schedule. It's kind of similar to what you're doing. I'd go to bed maybe around 6 a.m. I'd get up at some point in the afternoon. I was working at that time, kind of second shift style hours, so it all kind of worked anyway. But yeah, those were different times,
You look at how much computers have changed over even the last sort of 2 or 3 years. I mean, I saw a story a couple of days ago, or a couple of months ago, about SanDisk have just released a micro SD card with 200 gigabytes of memory. I mean,
It's crazy.
that's something the size of my little thumbnail, and
Yeah.
that's sort of 10 times more powerful than the first computer we had in this house.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I first got the internet in this house when, well, it must have been 2004, 2005, sometime like that.
Wow.
And it was, a dial-up modem.
Yeah.
And, you had to sort of plug it into the phone socket, plug it into the computer, and,
Yeah.
go all night. And because, you couldn't have phone calls and use the modem at the same time, it ended up with a situation where, I mean, even back then, it was sort of everybody goes to bed, I go online.
Yeah.
And, you can imagine what that led to.
Oh, yeah.
And it was really interesting. And now I'm in a situation where, I mean, I've got this computer, and it's what, 500 gigabytes memory, and it's my laptop.
Yeah.
And I think the first desktop computer we got in this house was, I don't know, 4 gigabytes, maybe something like that.
Right.
And things just go exponentially faster. Was it Moore's Law, is it? You know, computers
yeah. mm-hmm.
get twice as big and half as expensive or something like that.
Right. Yeah, you know, that that Pentium 75 that I had back in 96, it actually had one, just barely, it had 1 gigabyte of storage on the internal hard drive. And I just remember thinking, I'll never fill this up. Like, it was impossible to imagine that you would ever have enough data or enough applications to fill up 1 gigabyte of hard drive. And of course now, you know, your operating system on most modern computers probably runs, you know, anywhere between like 4 and 10 gigabytes just for the OS. That's before you put anything on it. So anyway.
Yeah, and that's what we're in now. I mean, like, so yeah. this laptop's 500 gigabytes. And one of the reasons why I've been sort of working all night and messing around is desperately trying to free up space.
Yeah.
You know, what can I delete? What can I move to my external hard drive? Because I've got what? It's not too bad at the moment. 72 gigabytes of free memory.
Uh-huh.
But it's become to sort of like 20 gigabytes over the last few days. And I've been, you know, messing about and, you know, consolidating video files into bigger things to, you know, save up space and, you know, make things easier to deal with. And, you know, it's, you know, a truism of human nature that if you've got a 4 gigabyte computer, you will fill it up. If you've got a 500 gigabyte computer, you will fill it up.
I will say that I've been lucky with this iMac because it came with a one terabyte internal drive. And not long after that, a friend of mine gave me a 1 terabyte USB drive. So I haven't really had any problems with that so far. And thankfully, once Jen got her iMac, which the same person who gave me the USB drive gave us that iMac, she's been fine. But when she was using that laptop, it really became a science project, you know, moving things onto external drives and trying to figure out how to make all the storage work. But I guess in the scope of everything that humanity has to deal with in 2015, these are not the deepest problems in the world, I hope.
No, we're definitely talking about first world problems.
Yeah, exactly. So anyway, enough of this reminiscing about 1400, you know, baud internet connections. So Colin, you know, just real quick, we'll do the quick introduction, but you are, of course, the creator and host of the Ouroboros podcast, which is going now continuously since 07. Is that correct? More or less?
Yes. I've just celebrated in February, I celebrated my 8th anniversary for the Ouroboros podcast.
Okay. Well done.
And, yeah. And I've also been doing a film review podcast, Raw Footage, for 4 years now? 3 years.
Okay.
3 or 4 years.
Okay.
I don't keep it as good a track of how long I've been doing that, but
yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, so you were someone who listened to, you know, Hyper Nonsense the first time around and all the stuff that came after that. So, I mean, we've been, you know, friends for a long time and, you know, but I figured maybe there's some new people listening. I have no idea. So it's just worth doing a quick introduction here as far as that is concerned. Now, I wanted to ask you a few things because you just recently finished on your Ouroboros show. You did this really in-depth breakdown and review of 50 Shades of Grey, not just the movie, because you went back. You started with the books, right? You read because you knew you were going to talk about this on your film review show. So you decided that
not
you wanted to.
Exactly.
So why did you decide to go back? Because did you watch the movie first or did you read the books first?
No, I haven't watched the movie and I haven't read the books.
Oh, okay. I thought you did.
What happened was, the Ouroboros podcast, it basically started out as a music show, but over the years it has kind of morphed. So So while you will hear about, you know, 45 minutes to an hour's worth of music, you'll also hear about half an hour to 45 minutes of me ranting about stuff. And this means that I'm usually in a situation where I'm thinking, what am I going to talk about on the podcast this weekend? You know, is there something that's angered me? Is there something that's interested me? And I was thinking about, you know, what I was going to talk about on that weekend's show when I was waiting for the bus to go over to see a film in Bristol. And it struck me that the film I was about to go and see over in Bristol was a British art house film called The Duke of Burgundy, which was about a lesbian BDSM relationship.
Okay.
And it struck me that I was really interested in seeing this film about BDSM, but I had absolutely no interest in the film, which was going to be massively more successful.
Okay.
Massively more,
I remember,
mainstream
now. Yeah, okay.
50 Shades of Grey. So that got me interested, and I was thinking, right, I can talk about 50 Shades of Grey and how it's this huge cultural phenomena in comparison to The Duke of Burgundy.
Yeah.
But once I start, when I got an extra legal copy of the books,
uh-huh.
and I started reading them, and I reached a certain point. I mean, I read the first chapter and I skipped ahead to the first sex scene and I thought, this is just so poorly written. I cannot do this. I cannot put myself through this.
Okay.
So I ended up going to a couple of blogs, and they were doing chapter by chapter breakdowns of the 50 Shades of Grey books. So basically, I started reading these blogs and used those to form my opinion of 50 Shades of Grey. And gradually, I started getting so many opinions that it spread over 3 podcasts.
Yeah.
Because I had so much to talk about. And these books and the film, although I still haven't seen the film, these books in this film are so dangerous,
uh-huh.
I believe. That I really wanted to give my opinion on why they were so dangerous,
yeah.
and why people should avoid them, and also point people in the direction of films like The Duke of Burgundy, which is actually really good, and other films like Secretary, which deal with BDSM relationships, and say, you know, this is what BDSM actually is. Ignore
right.
50 Shades of Grey. It's not BDSM. It's not kinky. It's a story about an abusive stalker.
Yeah.
Rapist. I mean, there are several scenes in the 3 50 Shades of Grey books which perfectly fit the definition of rape.
Well,
so
and one
people,
of the one of the thing I don't want to interrupt you, but one of the things that you did, which I thought was actually pretty brilliant, is you went out and you again extra legally acquired copies of the audiobooks. And you actually took out, you know, specific passages so that your listeners could hear the audio of where, you know, you're clearly making your case of this. You can just listen to the actual source material and go, no, this is not a consensual, you know, healthy relationship. Here's why. And then you actually hear, you know, the audio. And when you do, you realize, wow, this is not good.
Yeah, I did get a complaint about that. I mean, I only used one extract from 50 Shades of Grey. I did use some audio extracts for my tribute to Terry Pratchett, which was the next episode along.
Yeah.
But, I mean, that one sex scene, I mean, it was relatively short. It was 7 minutes.
Yeah.
And I thought it perfectly encapsulated everything that was so, so wrong with this relationship. I mean, because basically it's a scene where, you know, the characters are Anastasia and Christian. I mean, Anastasia is upset, legitimately upset for a good reason. So she doesn't want to have sex. She is coerced into having sex by Christian.
Yeah.
And she's not into it because she didn't want to have sex. Yet when Christian tells her to come, she does.
Yeah.
And well, this is supposed to be held up as this ideal of,
right.
of romance and kink, and it's just not.
And the other thing that really struck me is, okay, the story is written from the first person perspective. So you're, you know, if it just seems to me like if you took, again, you know, you kind of isolated that one part, but even if you just like read over the text where it's, you know,
awfully written as well. It's badly written.
But I mean, it just seems like if you just, you know, when you isolate it and you break it down like that, you really see that, no, this really isn't cool. And, you know, unfortunately, a lot of people, as you point out, are going to have, you know, they're going to see this as kind of their, you know, this may be their introduction into this, the whole BDSM thing. And one thing that I've been, you know, kind of, I don't know, confused isn't quite the right word, but just hasn't been able to make a lot of sense to me with this whole phenomenon that's come up through this 50 Shades of Grey thing is, and maybe, Colin, you have some thoughts on this, but why do you think this has become such a huge phenomenon? Why has it become so popular? Is it just because of, you know, lucky marketing? Because, you know, it's generally considered by anyone who, you know, cares about art, cares about literature, you know, it's not considered good. No one says this is really good because of this. And there are, you know, obviously lots of examples in the history of, you know, pop culture things where, you know, things that aren't necessarily good become popular. So, you know, that's one thing. But it just seems weird to me that this has become so popular and it's seen as this kind of, you know, I don't want to say chicklet thing, but it's seen as being at its base kind of very appealing to women in kind of this very generalized way. And when I think of, I don't know, you know, romantic stories or things that we sort of traditionally think, oh, those are for women, you know, I don't think of a situation where it's heavily based in this whole BDSM thing. And that's where I'm trying to kind of figure out, well, how does this become so popular? I mean, do you have any thoughts on that?
Luck. I think it was the one thing which it became culturally acceptable to read and talk about. I mean, in one of the shows I did, I made the comparison to Deep Throats, the porn film from 1973. Yeah.
Okay.
Where, for whatever reason, this one sexually explicit piece of media became acceptable. And because it became acceptable, because people were talking about it, everybody wanted to talk about it. Okay. Everybody wanted to be part of that conversation. And I think it's really, really unfortunate that this conversation, which I do believe needs to be had, I do think that a more open and important conversation about sex and sexuality needs to be had in society at large. And if 50 Shades of Grey starts that, that's great.
Yeah.
But this specific piece of material, this book, and now this film, for whatever reason, this was in the right place at the right time, and this was the thing that people latched onto. And it's really, really unfortunate because it's bad. It is badly written. It's a bad portrayal of BDSM behavior. And it's terrible to me that this piece of media made that leap into the mainstream when there are hundreds of pieces of erotic literature or erotic films or whatever, which are substantially better than this, and didn't make that leap into the mainstream.
Yeah.
And I just think it's luck. I mean, this was the one book in the right place at the right time. And women, well, because I do think we are primarily talking about women here.
Yeah.
Women decided that now was the time when it was okay to be open about this kind of thing. And I did see an interesting article last year, I think it was, where somebody attributed the success of 50 Shades of Grey to the success of the Kindle.
Oh, interesting.
Because,
yeah,
because you've got all these women on computer trains or on buses with e-readers. You don't see the covers, so they can read whatever they want.
Yeah.
And they can read erotica if they so desire.
Yeah.
And for whatever reason, it was this particular piece of erotica.
Well, and not even
public imagination.
I mean, not even just the Kindle, but just e-books in general, because, you know, most people are walking around now with a device that'll allow them to see an e-book. So that's actually really interesting, and I hadn't thought of that before. Now, one thing that you mentioned and is kind of widely known or understood, but maybe you can elaborate on this a little more for me because I'm curious. So this story somehow has its roots in what is essentially a Twilight fan fiction. I mean, can you explain how it started? Do you know how it started as that and then eventually became this novel that was published?
This is a whole other story and a whole other aspect as to why this is terrible. Basically, this woman who goes by the pen name E.L. James, she's British, and she wrote this piece of Twilight fan fiction called Master of the Universe, which portrayed Edward Cullen as this dominant vampire and whatever, and Bella as the submissive, meek whatever. And not only was this based on Twilight as its core source material, it was also based on other fan fiction.
Oh, okay.
So this, which had gone into this realm of portraying Edward and Bella as part of a BDSM dominant submissive relationship.
Okay.
So she wrote this. She published it on fanfiction.net. It became somewhat popular. And eventually it got popular enough that she split off into her own website, masteroftheuniverse.com or whatever. I'm not exactly sure what it was.
Yeah.
But when the publishers of Twilight started nosing around saying, hang on, you're taking things too far here.
Yeah.
What she did is she went through this fan fiction she'd written, Masters of the Universe, and changed the names. That's essentially what she did. She changed the names. She made it a story about a rich man and a naive girl rather than a vampire and a naive girl, and published it herself, you know, through these ebook things, Amazon store, whatever.
Sure, yeah.
And that original ebook, self-published ebook, started being called 50 Shades of Grey, and that started becoming popular. And eventually, this publishing house, I think it was Vintage Books, realized that, oh, hang on, this is getting quite popular. We should actually publish this. So they did. And it all spiraled from there. So basically, not only is this woman, E.L. James, who published the original story under the pseudonym Snow Queen's Ice Dragon.
Yeah.
Not only is she plagiarizing Twilight, she's also plagiarizing other pieces of fan fiction set in the Twilight universe, which cast the characters in this kind of BDSM role.
Wow.
And it's really, really bad. I mean, you go through the actual text of the book, and I don't think Vintage Books did anything to it. I mean, there are serious grammatical and logical errors throughout the text of all three books. I don't think they hired a copy editor at all. They just published it because you can do that, because you can just slap it on the Kindle store, whatever, and you can publish it. People are going to buy it. And I mean, Vintage Books should be ashamed of themselves, really, for not only promoting this almost entirely plagiarized work. I mean, there are scenes, I mean, I haven't read Twilight, but I am assured that there are scenes in Fifty Shades of Grey, you know, the trilogy of the Fifty Shades of Grey books,
yeah,
which are direct lifts from Twilight. And she didn't even try to hide it that much. So, yeah, she's an awful, awful person. And whenever anybody accuses her of plagiarism, she vehemently denies it and gets her fans to attack whoever.
Oh, great.
Said those things.
Yeah.
And whenever she's accused of promoting sexual abuse, which is essentially what she's doing, because this is not a safe, consensual BDSM relationship, this is a stalker, rapist relationship. Whenever anybody accuses her of that, she too fights back hard and gets her fans to fight back hard. I mean, I saw a story where a survivor of an abusive marriage contacted her on Twitter, and E.L. James sent back a GIF with, it was taken from the film The Heat, I don't know if you were a Melissa McCarthy film, where Melissa McCarthy comes into a room and throws a book at somebody,
okay,
and it says, read the book. So this survivor of an abusive relationship gets sent a GIF promoting violence.
Wow.
From the author.
Yeah, that's not
she
good.
She's an awful, awful woman.
Well, you know, one of the things I remember that you mentioned is, as apparently as this story goes on across the different books, the main character, Anastasia, she learns that Christian Grey, and I don't know, spoilers here, maybe, potentially, if anyone cares.
Oh, so, fuck spoilers.
Yeah, no, I feel the same way, but I'll just throw it out there. I highly doubt anybody who listens to this show cares about having anything from 50 Shades of Grey spoiled, but hey, I don't know. I don't want to ruin anybody's weekend, so. Anyway, as these stories go on, it's discovered, I guess, that Christian Grey has this history with a woman who he had a relationship with, and she abused him, right? That's kind of the backstory, yeah, that they're creating here. So there's a point in there where this woman sort of comes into the story, and I don't remember exactly how everything unfolds, but this woman, you know, comes back, and there's, you know, these things are going on, and Anastasia can't tell anybody about this whole situation because she had, you know, essentially signed some, you know, non-disclosure agreement with Christian Grey about all the things they were going to do, and she can't talk about anything publicly. And you were kind of saying, you know, this is exactly where, you know, the story, the actual novel parallels the original fan fiction, because Bella can't tell anyone about how Edward's a vampire and all that. And I just thought, wow, you know, I would have never thought of it that way, but there's a place in there where you can actually see it goes straight back through to the original source material. And it's just another one of those moments where you realize, wow, you know, this isn't actually that good.
Yeah, I mean, that whole thing with the older woman, I mean, that's wrong on several levels.
Right, right.
I mean, firstly, the way the story goes, Christian, at the age of 15, gets seduced by one of his mother's friends, so a substantially older woman than him.
Yeah.
And for the next 6 years, he is a submissive in a BDSM relationship. So the implication, the clear implication of the book or books, is that because Christian was abused, he's into BDSM.
Yeah.
Which is not it at all. That
right.
is not how BDSM works.
Yeah.
And the other thing that is fundamentally wrong with this thing is the fact that when Anastasia hears about this, her first reaction is not sympathy for Christian for going through this abuse for 6 years. I mean, this child abuse for 6 years. She is jealous of the older woman because they've had this relationship, this long-standing relationship.
Yeah.
I mean, so what if he was below the age of consent? I mean, they still had this relationship, and
right.
she is jealous of her, and that's so, so wrong. But I mean, primarily, what is wrong about that is the idea that BDSM, anything kinky, is something to be ashamed of. It is something that is caused by being abused. It's not something that is healthy. It's not something that in a safe, consensual circumstances can be beneficial. It is something that you have to get past. It is a psychological damage which needs to be fixed.
Well, and that's one of the things that I thought when I was trying to wrap my mind around why this became so popular with women, you know, so specifically. And I wondered if part of the allure of this whole thing is that, okay, you know, the Christian Grey character, you know, he has this whatever background, and, you know, he has, you know, maybe he has, you know, trouble with real intimacy, and the, you know, through the course of the story, you know, Anastasia sort of breaks through that wall, and he really actually grows and trusts her, and maybe that's part of the, you know, allure of why, you know, people are reading this who might normally be drawn to more kind of, I don't know, traditional romance stories or whatever, and that's kind of the payoff, which I don't really think is, if that's the case, I don't really think it's good. But it made me wonder if maybe that's part of the mindset of people who are reading this, that they're kind of waiting for that to happen. And you even, you know, said on your show that, you know, it kind of seems like one of the overriding themes here is that through the course of all this, Anastasia sort of quote unquote cures him. And it's like, that is so much the wrong message, you know, to put out here. I mean, you know, besides the fact that they're having this incredibly, you know, dysfunctional relationship and the non-consensual nature of so many things that happen and, you know, what is effectively rape, let's just call it what it is. But I mean, and I think you kind of pointed that out. I mean, that it's kind of played off in the end, like, oh, she sort of cures him of this thing that's wrong with him. And that's just really bad.
Yeah. I mean, I think at its heart, I mean, one of the reasons why this book has become this cultural phenomenon is I think it taps into two different fantasies that women have. I think it is a very, very common fantasy for a woman to want to be dominated, to give up control, even to be raped. I mean, that is a common fantasy.
Yeah.
And taken as a fantasy, that's fine. That's reasonably healthy.
Yeah.
But the other thing it taps into is this idea of curing this damaged man through love. I mean, if I love him enough, he will stop hitting me.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, I think that too is a common fantasy, a common idea, and that is very, very unhealthy. And with Snow Queen's Ice Dragon promoting this kind of idea that you can cure somebody by loving them enough, and you're just going to have to put up with the abuse, when that is presented, that is incredibly dangerous.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things I wanted to discuss and to promote, that idea that these are not just badly written books. These are not just bad books. They are dangerous books.
Yeah. Well, I don't really know what else to say about it. I feel like at a certain level, since I haven't read the books, I haven't seen the movie, and I'm getting a lot of this commentary kind of secondhand that I on one level, maybe I don't have any authority to really, you know, say much about it. But I really just, you know, the thing that has fascinated me more than anything else is how this has become so popular. And I feel like we've covered that enough. So I think we can move on to the next thing. Now, we don't mention it all that often on this podcast, but Jen and I have another website that we run. Mostly it's her. She's added the majority, the vast majority of all the content that's there. But we have a website called nomarket.org. It's the No Market Collective. And over there, we do, it's just kind of a, we just put anything we want over there. It's just got everything. So there's sections devoted to, Jen writes these video game blogs, and then there's, she writes these, you know, political blogs, and then we have, you know, cultural commentary, pop culture stuff, writing, poetry, all that kind of stuff. Anything that we want to make that we don't necessarily want to devote an entire website to, it goes over there. And every now and then, cool, smart people that we know will write their own, will contribute stuff to the site. You know, and Colin, you've written a few things over there. And one of them was when you applied this thing called the Bechdel test to Doctor Who and the West Wing. And it's this really brilliant, you know, analysis, long, I don't even know how many words long, but it was thorough. Let's just put that. And that's one of the things that when it comes to this kind of stuff, like the 50 Shades of Grey, that I like about what you do, Colin, because you instead of, it's easy enough for, you know, some idiot like me to just go on Twitter and go, oh man, the 50 Shades of Grey looks dumb. But you went, okay, no, let's really figure out what's going on here. And you really did, you know, as much of an evaluation, you know, as you could, given the fact that you pretty much found the books unreadable and you haven't seen the movie. But not all that withstanding, I think you still did a pretty good analysis of what's there. So getting back to this piece that you wrote for us about the Bechdel test, explain real quick what the Bechdel test is.
Right. Basically, it is a simple, well, relatively simple set of criteria which aims to say how well a piece of media portrays women.
Mm-hmm.
It was originally devised by a lesbian cartoonist named Alison Bechdel in 1985, I think it was.
Yeah.
She was writing this comic, a lesbian-themed comic, and in it, one of the characters says, I only watch films that pass these three criteria. And those criteria are, this film must have at least two named female characters. They must have a conversation with each other, and that conversation must be about something other than a man.
Okay.
And if you can say those three things about the film or TV show or book or whatever that you're watching or reading, then it passes the Bechdel test. But it is a flawed system, and that's one of the things I talked about in the article.
Yeah. Well, it's an interesting little kind of rule that you can apply to, you know, different things, be they movies, books, whatever, to just kind of determine if, you know, the whole thing isn't just, no matter how many characters in it, how many of them are female, if it's not ultimately just a story that is, you know, completely focused on a male character. But the reason I asked about it is, I don't know if you're aware of this, but there was a, I don't know if you could really call it a feminist anthem so much, a few years back by a poet, a laureate of our times, one Mr. Sir Mix-a-Lot. And Mix-a-Lot had a song called Baby Got Back. People might remember it. It was on the radio a few times. Well, the music video for Sir Mix-a-Lot, now let's, you know, thinking about this in a little bit of a different way, let's kind of think of Baby Got Back as a story, perhaps a first-person narrative in which Mix-a-Lot is, you know, essentially the protagonist. Now, if you watch the video for the song, Baby Got Back, this is how it starts.
Oh my God, Becky, look at her butt. It is so big. She looks like one of those rap guys' girlfriends. Who understands those rap guys? They only talk to her because she looks like a total prostitute, okay? I mean, her butt is just so big. I can't believe it's just so round. It's like out there. I mean, gross. Look. She's just so black.
I like big butts and I can't.
All right, so if we apply the Bechdel test to the Sir Mix-a-Lot video, it starts with two women talking to each other about another woman. So in theory, if we just skew the medium a little bit, in theory, Baby Got Back passes the Bechdel test. Do you agree?
Right. Well, this is another problem with the Bechdel test, because it's requires a lot of interpretation.
Right. Right.
And I would argue that that little clip you just played doesn't pass any level.
Oh, come on.
But because only one of the women is named.
Yeah.
And you could argue that the conversation that they are having is about another woman, but it is about another woman in talking about how attractive she is to a man.
I didn't think about that.
So if you wanted to, you could also say,
but hold on.
Even if you say it passes the first part of having two women talking to each other, you could argue that it doesn't pass the third part because the conversation is, you know, the context of the conversation is a man.
Yeah.
So I personally argue that it doesn't pass any.
Okay. I guess you're right. I guess you're right. I'm kind of disappointed now. Jen had saw that somewhere. She saw it on Twitter or Tumblr or something, and someone said, you know, if you think about it, this thing actually passes the Bechdel test. And I went,
I can definitely see that you could argue it passes.
Yeah, the Bechdel test. It's close.
Personally, wouldn't.
It's close.
Trouble. I mean, even if a film passes the Bechdel test, or even if it fails the Bechdel test, it doesn't mean it is quote-unquote feminist or quote-unquote not feminist.
Yeah.
I mean, the examples I always use and the examples I used in the article were the films Captain America, The First Avenger, and what's that bloody thing called? Sucker Punch.
Uh-huh.
Because Captain America, The First Avenger fails all three levels of the Bechdel test. Because there's only one named female character in it.
Yeah.
But that named female character has authority in the film, is not treated as a sex object, and at one point punches out a male character who gets too intimate with her.
Uh-huh.
Whereas Sucker Punch passes all three levels of the Bechdel test because it is a film largely revolving around women, but those women are working in a brothel and spend the entire film in various revealing skimpy outfits. So I would definitely call, if anything, I would call it a misogynist film. Yes, it passes all three levels of the Bechdel test.
Yeah.
So this is not a perfect system. And that's one of the things I wanted to talk about in the article, you know, my opinion on why it fails and, you know, where it's good, where it's bad.
Well, yeah, I just I had to bring that up because when I heard it, I thought it was so funny, and I said, "Okay, I know when we have Colin on the show, we've got to bring this up because I know he's got some experience with you know, judging things against the Bechdel test." So now, in that you mentioned the Captain America, which brings me to another thing that I wanted to talk to you about, because back when we were, you know, arranging to have you on, you know, the last podcast we did before that then went away and then this started up again, that was right around the time when Jen and I had watched, in like the span of a week, we had watched all of these new Avenger movies, starting with the first Iron Man movie. And I think we went all the way up through Avengers, or Iron Man 2. And I think we got all the way up through Iron Man 2. And we watched them because most of them we hadn't seen. We actually watched them not in the order of production, but in the order of if you wanted to watch these as sort of a story that has a beginning point and, you know, an end point so much as it would have at that time. And I don't remember the exact order we watched them in, but that's how we watched them. So we would see, you know, the stories that these movies depict kind of unfold in as much of a linear, you know, pattern as possible. And at the time, you know, I really enjoyed them. And while, you know, there's problems and they have, you know, some issues as all, you know, films do, or certainly anytime, you know, they try to get this blown up with a big franchise like this, there's going to be problems. But for the most part, I thought they did a good job and I enjoyed the movies. Now, I have to come into this saying that the whole superhero thing is not really my bag. I never got that much into it. I like these Avenger movies for what they are. And, you know, I like some of the Batman movies. But I never got into comics. I never got into superheroes that much. You know, science fiction and things that tend to run more along that line are kind of more my interest. Every now and then, something outside of that catches my fancy. But, you know, I don't have a long history with all that, with any of that. I never got into it as a kid. Just never really been my bag. Now, that's fine. I'm not here to judge anybody else who's into it. You know, do what you like. Have fun. You know, life is short. Whatever. But I remember at the time you were saying that, you know, well, our opinions on it were not right, or, you know, you had your own thoughts about, you know, the whole thing. And at that time, you know, we were looking forward to, well, what were the next movies that were going to come out? And one of them that was planned down the road, which I think is going to come out either this year or next year, is Ant-Man. And I was like, Ant-Man, nobody cares about Ant-Man. That's going to be one of the dumbest movies they ever made. And somewhere, it was either on your own show or in the comments to our show, you said, oh, no, Ant-Man's fantastic. He's a drunk. He's a wife beater. And then I thought, okay, well, now you got my attention. So tell me, you know, first of all, I guess, I don't know. I mean, how do you feel at this point now? And it's been a few years and there's been a whole TV show and all these other movies.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, how do you feel that they've handled this whole Avengers, you know, franchise in this form? I mean, do you think it's good, or do you feel that it's not good, it's not true to whatever source material came before it or anything like that? I mean, what's your, without breaking it down to, you know, a 10,000 word blog post, I mean, how do you feel they're handling it overall so far? Educate me as someone who's coming to it strictly from all I really know is what I've seen in the movies. I haven't even seen the TV show. I haven't even seen any of the movies since then. So for all I know, they've completely fallen off. But as someone who is just a very casual observer of these things, you know, you educate me and tell me what they've done right and or wrong, if anything.
I think that living in the world we do now, where the Avengers has happened, where all these films have linked up together, it's important to remember just how unlikely this whole thing was.
Yeah.
Nobody had ever tried anything like this before.
No, no way.
Yeah, we are going to have 4 or 5 different films, you know, completely separate films with completely separate characters. They're occasionally going to intersect. They're occasionally going to brush up against each other. But then we're going to bring them all together to make this one film. And that's astonishing. The achievement of managing to do that and make the film good. I mean, I absolutely loved the Avengers film. I mean, I thought it was brilliant.
Yeah.
The fact that they managed to do it cannot be underestimated at all.
Yeah, and that was one of my my big praises for the whole thing is I went, you know, in my lifetime, I couldn't think of anything that, you know, Hollywood had done that was so wide-ranging in scope. And for the most part, they seemed to get a lot of the loose ends, you know, mostly in check. And that's where these things tend to fall apart. You know, as soon as you get more than, you know, a couple of writers in the mix, that's when these things start to kind of disintegrate and you start to see major plot holes. That's why with a lot of franchises that are long running, you know, these things just happen. So that was one of the things that I was really impressed with in watching those movies in such a short period of time, where I could see these little moments where, okay, that ties into that, and they don't go out of there, they don't hit you over the head with it. Like, it's there if you want to see it, but if you miss it, it's not a big deal. And not only that, but for the most part, the films themselves, at least up through the point that I saw them, were mostly self-contained in the sense that it's not like you had to do like we did, where you watch everything from, you know, Iron Man all the way through Avengers. And then when you get to Avengers, you will have maybe a little better understanding of everything. But I think if someone just came in off the street, watched Avengers, they would get a fully, you know, formed movie that they could enjoy for what it is. And then if they took the time to see all that extra stuff, it would, you know, potentially enhance the experience. And that is what I thought was impressive. So anyway, please go on.
Yeah, I mean, I think that is important. And I think it's important to realize that these Marvel movies have all been put under the same umbrella and have the same producer, this guy Kevin Feige, who runs the Marvel Films Division or whatever it's called. I don't know the exact title. But this guy, Kevin Feige, plans everything out in advance. I mean, we've got Marvel films planned for the next 5 years. I mean, that's how far in advance these things are done. He knows exactly where everything's going. He knows exactly how everything slots into each other. And when he hires directors, they accommodate the house style of Marvel. I mean, like the director of Guardians of the Galaxy was a guy called James Gunn. And he started his career in Troma. I mean, he's made some really low-budget, really schlocky films. And he's also made some really good films. I mean, he directed a film called Super, which I thought was brilliant. I mean, it was a kind of a story about a man who decides to become a superhero. I mean, he decides that I want to fight crime, so I'm going to hit people over the head with a wrench. I mean, it's a really dark, really shocking film. But when he did the Marvel film, when he did Guardians of the Galaxy, he curbed those more extreme aspects of his style to mold it into the Marvel Universe. And Joss Whedon did the same thing with Avengers. I mean, you look at Avengers and you say, oh yeah, that's a Joss Whedon line. But the overall approach, the overall style is contained within this Marvel Cinematic Universe. So you have a series of films, and my dog's just woken up.
I was going to say, what's going on? Everything okay?
Yeah.
Do you need to take a break?
He's going to settle down in a minute.
Okay.
Well, he should. And there he goes. Right. Where was I? Yeah, I mean, Joss Whedon molds his style. James Gunn molds his style. These are a series of films which are under the same umbrella, have the same creative team behind them. So they do feel consistent. They do have this universe to play in. But that's the big thing. What Marvel has created is so extraordinary and has been so financially successful that now everybody wants to do it.
Yeah.
I mean, DC Comics have tried to do the same thing with, you know, the Aquaman film, Wonder Woman films coming, and you've got Batman versus Superman. But the difference is that they're planning on doing all this stuff in 2 years, whereas Marvel took 4 years or five or 6 years, whatever. They really laid the groundwork. And now, because that's been done, DC is saying, no, we can do that too. We're going to rush through it. We're going to pound out these films. And it's not going to work.
Right.
I mean, now we've got things like Cinderella, for example, that's just been released. I mean, there's talk about, you know, a cinematic universe for all these old Disney properties as well. I mean, everybody wants to do this. And it's not always going to work. In fact, it's very rarely going to work because they're not going to take the time and the care that Marvel took. I mean, they set out on this project when they did Iron Man. They said, right, we're going to plan out these films. If they're financially successful, we can roll, keep on rolling. And we are going to eventually reach this point where we can do the Avengers. They were patient about it. And they had the time and the resources to be patient about it. But now, Hollywood being a system which copies what's successful, everybody wants to do it, and it's not going to be successful. And we are now living in a world where this kind of universe-spanning thing, which brings all these films together, is a pattern that everybody wants to do. And it's not going to be successful. So what Marvel has done, I think, is extraordinary and should be applauded. But what they have done to the psychology and the pattern of what Hollywood is doing, that's dangerous. Yeah. That is going to end up with some really, really shoddily made films because everybody's going to rush everything together and try and put things together which don't really need to be put together. And, yeah, so there's good and there's bad in this whole thing. But what Marvel is actually doing, I think, is really impressive.
Well, I don't really think that, you know, I mean, given the fact that it's been successful, I don't really think that is something that Marvel should take any blame for. I feel like, you know, if these other companies rush in to try and emulate what they've done and do it poorly, which odds are they will, you know, that's usually how these things work.
DC's history.
Now, for someone like me, again, who's not much of an aficionado when it comes to the whole comic book superhero thing, it's always seemed to me, even going back, you know, a long ways back, when I had, as pretty much always, just kind of the most sort of cursory knowledge of these franchises, that the Marvel characters always seem to have a little more depth or a little more realism to them. You know, I don't know, maybe Thor withstanding, but, you know, a little more depth, a little more realism than some of most of the DC characters. And I understand now that we're going to see, you know, they're going to have their opportunities now to give all these characters their origin stories. I mean, arguably, if they want to build off of what's already there, and part of me wants to say that they will, but knowing how these things go, they probably won't. I don't know if their plan is to kind of sort of work like, say, the Dark Knight movies that are already out there, if those are going to kind of get worked into these other movies, or if they're just going to kind of reset the whole thing. But, you know, it's always felt to me like there was a little more substance behind what Marvel did than DC, but I could be wrong. Do you have any thoughts one way or the other?
I think that's definitely true. I think the clear and most obvious difference between Marvel and DC is that level of humanity, that level of realism. I mean, Spider-Man lives in New York.
Right.
Daredevil lives in Hell's Kitchen in New York. Superman lives in Metropolis. Batman lives in Gotham.
Right.
I mean, that was always the pattern with Marvel. I mean, we are going to set this in as much of the real world as possible.
Yeah.
And because they've always had that approach, it is easier to have a situation where everything can combine together. I mean, you have Spider-Man flying past the Fantastic Four building in comic books.
Yeah.
You have the Avengers Tower showing up all over the place in the Marvel comic books. I mean, it was always a unified universe.
Yeah.
Whereas DC did that thing, you know, we're going to have Gotham, we're going to have Metropolis, we're going to have Star City, whatever. And that's fine if that's what you want to do. But if you're going to try and amalgamate everything, it's not going to work so well. And, you know, the Dark Knight trilogy is going to be standalone. That's finished. Okay. That's done with. That's okay. One version of Batman. In this new Batman versus Superman film, Batman's going to be played by Ben Affleck.
Okay.
And that is seemingly going to be based on, well, somewhat based on a series of comic books written by Frank Miller, where Batman and Superman force each other.
Yeah.
And the point of that comic book written by Frank Miller was Superman has these godlike powers. Somebody needs to keep him in check.
Okay.
And Batman steps up and says, I'm going to keep you in check.
Yeah.
And judging by what happens at the end of Man of Steel, the last Superman film, I really do hope that's going to be what the pattern is. Because the thing that I really, really hated about Man of Steel, directed by Zack Snyder, who also did Sucker Punch, was at the end of that film, you had this big battle between Superman and General Zod, you know, standard mm-hmm. character from the Superman comic books. But this battle completely levels Metropolis. There are thousands of people either dead or homeless, and it's not mentioned at all.
Mm.
So if Batman comes in this new Batman vs. Superman film and says, hang on, you need to check yourself, that is what I hope happens.
Okay.
But honestly, I don't know. And we actually talked a little bit about this on my last show with the cast of Gal Gadot as Wonder Woman.
Uh-huh.
And the fact that her breast size is apparently not big enough, which is stupid.
Yeah.
But that idea of keeping this godlike being in check, I really hope that's the direction they go. Because, I mean, like I said, DC are going to accelerate through this process that Marvel was so patient and took such a long time with. I mean, I think they're going to have a Justice League movie in 2 years, and that's just not enough time,
yeah,
given the amount of films that are going to be released before that. And it's...
I wonder, too...
See it becoming a train wreck.
Yeah. I wonder, too, if trying to, you know, emulate what Marvel has done and doing it in such a compressed timeline, if that isn't only going to create, you know, diluted product... But if the other side of that is just that people are going to get fatigued, you know, when you throw that much, you know, we're not, you know, it's weird because we live in this time when we're so, you know, attention, you know, there's such an attention deficit, right, for everyone, because there's just stuff going on around us all the time. There's this sort of unwritten understanding that we're all just sitting around waiting for the next thing to happen. And, you know, we see this expressed in things like, you know, binge viewing and, you know, the release of Netflix produces a TV show and you can watch the whole thing, you know, you can watch an entire season in a day or whatever the case may be. Yet, I do think that at some level, there is still an appreciation for, you know, that kind of slow burn or that slow build up to the thing where you're going to be like, okay, I've been with this for a few years and now I'm ready for the big payoff and I get it. And it's like super satisfying. And I think that there is kind of a burnout that happens when something is just out there constantly all the time. And you feel like you can't get away from it. And you're like, oh, yeah, we've got to go see another one of these DC movies now. So I don't think it's going to help them. And I think it's going to be even worse from the fact that, you know, they are working with, you know, let's just face it, kind of weaker source material. So now they might.
Well, I wouldn't say that. Okay. I think certainly on the film side of things, DC has mishandled their previous films, apart from Christopher Nolan, who did the Dark Knight trilogy and was essentially allowed to do his own thing.
Yeah.
Apart from that, DC has completely botched everything they've done on cinema, including having this really, really accelerated schedule for the Justice League film. And I mean, I think you're right. I think fatigue is definitely going to become a factor.
Yeah.
Sooner or later, one of these big superhero blockbusters is going to absolutely bomb.
Flop, yeah.
And that could be, you know, a domino which falls, and you know, suddenly the pattern is going to be broken. I mean, something somewhat similar happened with the last Spider-Man film.
Yeah.
I mean, that didn't do particularly well financially or critically. I didn't like it, certainly. And now we're going to have another Spider-Man, you know, the third Spider-Man in 12 years, and that's another thing I talked about on the last Ouroboros. But that wasn't an absolute disaster, but it did badly enough that Sony, who owned the rights, said, we can't do this anymore. Here, Marvel, you have Spider-Man. Include him in the Avengers, which is what the comic book fans wanted, but me as a film fan, I really don't like, because we're going to have a Spider-Man film, which means that the first black Marvel superhero, Black Panther, his film got delayed, and the first female Marvel superhero, Captain Marvel, that film's also got delayed, and those characters we haven't seen on the big screen yet.
Yeah.
And because we've got this new Spider-Man film, they're getting delayed. So, yeah, I mean, we've somewhat seen that with Sony just giving up and saying, no, you can have Spider-Man back. But sooner or later, there is going to be an absolutely financially disastrous superhero film. I mean, it's bound to happen eventually, and that could cause issues for the pattern that we've been seeing over the last few years.
And one thing that I think about now with regards to this whole, you know, viewer fatigue thing, you know, these things become incredibly successful, especially thinking about something like the Avengers, because they will draw in people who are really, like, I can say, okay, I'm not a comic fan, I'm not a superhero, you know, fan, that whole genre doesn't really appeal to me that much, but I will watch those kind of movies, you know, especially if they're good, that helps, but I'll probably watch them anyway, just because I'm kind of a fan of that kind of thing. But there's a lot of people who aren't going to understand, like, they're not going to kind of inherently understand the difference between Marvel and DC. They're just going to see this constant line of superhero movies and, you know, oh, another one of these. So in a way, it's almost like now, you know, Marvel has kind of been able to dominate this for so long, and then all of a sudden these other movies are going to come out. And I don't know, it could really turn into a problem, not just for, you know, DC trying to rush all their movies out, but it could even become just like an overall, you know, fatigue level of the genre, that people may take a break from just going to the movies in general. And that's where, you know, as even as a casual fan as I am, say, of what Marvel's been doing, that's even more discouraging, because, you know, we like to think that in a rational world, you could go, okay, these movies have made all this money so far. So what that means is they've got this huge cushion to keep making these movies. And maybe if they have a few that aren't as viable financially, they'll still have this cushion to work from. And we all know that Hollywood ain't going to work like that. That if they have, you know, like, we'll just stay with the Marvel movies. If they have one that really just bombs, it probably won't derail the whole thing. But if the next one that comes up after it doesn't bring it all the way back and then some, then it's going to start to get shaky. And that's where you got to worried about this.
Honestly, that's not an issue, because
you don't think so?
Marvel. Marvel is owned by Disney.
Uh-huh.
You know, you've got Disney, ABC, ESPN, all that kind of stuff. I mean, Marvel, speaking specifically about Marvel,
uh-huh.
they can have as many utter disasters as they like.
Okay.
It's not going to make a dent in Disney.
Yeah, it's not going to make a dent in Disney, but I always think of these things coming from the perspective of there's always, you know, suits and bean counters, and there's infinite levels of these people that are in between, you know, the people that want to that can and are willing to make the movies, and then the ones that are actually, you know, going to say yes, we're going to do it no matter what. And I feel like there comes a point where they go, well, we know that, you know, the last however many of these have been successful, but we had a bomb, and then we had one that was only okay, and, you know, our infinite army of, you know, bean counters is saying we can't take a risk like this year, even though we have all the money already. I don't know. I mean, maybe I'm wrong, and you know, them all being under the fold of Disney, which we all know Disney has no trouble. I mean, Disney can print its own money. They're doing it. Every day, they're doing it right now. Disney has made more money in the time that we've been recording this podcast than I'll probably make in my entire life. So they've got the money, but I just always feel like there's always a disconnect between the rational thinking that we can have, where we go, it's okay because they have all the money, and, you know, the corporate bottom line that says, yeah, we have all the money, but we want to make sure we continue to have all the money, so we can't do this anymore. And I hope I'm wrong. I hope I am.
I honestly don't think that's going to be a problem.
Okay.
Because, I mean, it's like I said earlier, I mean, everything that Marvel Films does is under the stewardship of Kevin Feige.
Mm-hmm.
And Kevin Feige is important enough in the Disney Corporation and has made enough money for the Disney Corporation in the past that he would have to have so many bombs in a row for him to lose that position that I honestly don't think it's going to be an issue. I mean, and we're only talking specifically about Marvel here. I mean, we've already seen that Sony with Spider-Man, they had two, not exactly bombs, but the two Spider-Man films they produced last didn't do astonishingly well, so they gave up on them.
Yeah.
So for other studios, this could be a problem. But for Marvel, Kevin Feige has done so much good for the Disney Corporation that it would have to be something extraordinary over an extended length of time for that to become an issue, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, yeah, maybe he would rethink this whole sort of 5-year plan into the future, which it's astonishing that, you know, people are going to be born today, that by the time, you know, the Inhumans film comes out in 2019, they're going to be old enough to watch it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's stupid that that happens, but he's done it. He's made so much money that he can get away with a lot of stuff. So in Marvel's case, I really don't think it's going to be an issue. But overall, if you include, you know, the Fantastic Four and X-Men films that are currently owned by Fox, and if you include the Spider-Man films, which is still semi-owned by Sony, if you include all of them together, I think we are definitely going to reach a point where fatigue will set in. And sooner or later, one of these films is going to absolutely bomb.
Yeah. Well, we'll just have to look forward to that day and hope that it just doesn't, you know, derail the whole thing.
I don't look forward to it. I mean, as long as these films continue to be at least entertaining, I'm going to still watch them.
But, yeah. Well, no, I don't mean look forward to it with anticipation. I mean, just look forward to it with a sense of reality that it's going to happen. And, you know, I don't want to wish anyone ill, but at this point, I kind of hope I hope the bomb one turns out to be a DC movie. So just because I really like I want the Marvel thing to stay strong. You know, I will give my heart and my mind over to anything DC does in time and let them, you know, win me over. But right now I'm enjoying what the Marvel, you know, the Marvel franchise is doing, and I'm desperately out of date and all of it. I haven't seen the TV show. I haven't seen, you know, the last, I don't know how many movies. I think I've missed two movies now. So,
at
you know.
Two.
Yeah.
Possibly three. No, yeah. No, at least three, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I haven't seen Iron Man 3 either, so, yeah, that's, I think there's been.
Yeah, I've missed, you, so you
haven't Winter
seen,
Soldier. I haven't seen Iron Man 3, Winter Soldier, or the second Thor movie. Have I missed anything else?
So you've got Guardians of the Galaxy.
Okay. That's going to be, that's part of this too?
Yeah.
Oh, I thought it was completely, yeah, that, I thought it was isolated from, separate of.
No, they're going to fold it in.
Okay.
So I mean, that's the point. It'd be even this sort of like larger cosmic scale story is going to be folded into the whole continuity of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. And, you know, I'm really interested to see how that's going to work. I mean, and, you know, Captain Marvel is a character which also goes on that cosmic scale. So I'm betting that she's going to show up in the second Guardians of the Galaxy film, which has already been announced. So.
Well, I guess I know. I guess I can start putting my list together for my next week of Marvel movies because I'm pretty much there.
Yeah. All right.
One last thing that I feel like I need to just share with you here, Colin. You know, you're obviously a huge Doctor Who fan. Not only did we talk about your application of the Bechdel test to Doctor Who and that huge thing that you wrote, which also included your analysis of Bechdel test versus the West Wing. But, yeah. You know, you do episode recaps of Doctor Who. Well, your commentary of, not recaps of necessarily, but your commentary on the Doctor Who episodes when they come out on your show. Well, I'm wondering if you've come across this yet. And I'm kind of doing this on the fly, so let's hope that it works. This is the...
Welcome to Dalek Relaxation for Humans!
This is the
deep breath in through your nose.
This is the Dalek relaxation tape.
Now exhale through your mouth, softly. Focus on slowing down your breathing into a calm rhythm. Inhale. You are becoming more and more calm. Exhale. You are feeling more and more relaxed.
Now, Colin, inhale, do you think that calm. If... Okay, let's just turn that down for now. But do you think, Colin, that maybe if you put the Dalek relaxation tape on, you know, in the early morning hours, maybe it would, you know, help you get to sleep sooner? You'd get more rest. Any thoughts?
Probably not. I'm begging
you. You're telling me that this would this the soothing sounds of the Daleks wouldn't. See? It's been exterminated, your tension. And that's the end of that.
Doctor Fandom is a strange and unusual place.
There's another one that I'm not, like, it's not even a matter of that I'm behind on it. I'm not even anywhere near it. You know, we watched the first series of the new Doctor Who back in, we watched it back in like 2008 or 2009, probably 08 is when we watched it, and we haven't seen any of it since. And nothing against it. I enjoyed the hell out of it. I liked the original Doctor Who series when I was a kid, so yeah, that's just a whole other thing that I'm like, you know, one day I'll get into it all, I promise. But right now it's just, I think it might be too much for me to deal with. I don't know.
Maybe. Yeah. Oh, so you, is the Christopher Eccleston?
Yes.
Series you watched.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah. And I really enjoyed it, but, you know, I just, I don't know. I've really gone over the last 4 to 5 years. I've really gone in a completely other way with TVs and movie and just all that stuff. And it's not that I'm not against it, you know? I don't feel like, I'm not one of these people that's like, I don't own a TV, you know? Like, yeah. That's not me at all. It's just as these weird progressions in my life, seemingly weird progressions in my life continue to go, I'm watching TV less and movies even more so. But I feel like I'll catch up with it all at some point. So, anyway, I do.
Yeah, I mean, I think the Christopher Eccleston season was, in retrospect, a test series. I think it was, you know, Doctor Who's back, what can we do with it? I mean, it really started hitting its stride with David Tennant and Matt Smith. Well, less with Matt Smith. But, yeah, I think it's something that if you can, you know, find it. I mean, it's probably on Netflix by now.
Yeah.
If you sort of watch episodes, I mean, you've probably heard this before, but watch the episode Blink.
Oh, yeah, it's, I keep hearing about
the
it.
Third series.
Yeah.
And it's brilliant. I mean, it actually stars Carey Mulligan, who's gone on to become a serious Hollywood actress. And it's, yeah, it's a classic of the type of creepy, unusual Doctor Who story that Stephen Moffat used to do so well, although not so much since he's actually been running the show. But,
you know,
yeah, it has its ups and downs, but there are certain episodes where you think, wow, that was excellent, and yeah.
Well, it's one of those things that I will get into. I mean, I'm starting to reach this point where I'm looking at different shows and kind of going, and because some of it is, I think, or I know Jen wants to watch it, so I'm trying to kind of wait and watch it with her. And, you know, her schedule's been so weird and erratic. So I've been watching, you know, a lot of shows on my own. There are things I know she has no interest in, but I'm starting to reach the point where I go, I don't know, maybe it's just, it's never going to work out that way. And because a lot of times when we do watch TV together, we just watch like, you know, reality type shows and stuff, things that don't require a lot of, you know, mental investment, a lot of mental, you know, emotional investment. And a lot of these shows now, as great as they are, you know, things like Doctor Who, there is kind of a serialized nature sometimes where if you watch one episode and you have a really long break, or you watch one series and you have a really long break into the next one, it can be a little challenging to kind of keep up. So, and you know, in its own way, I think that's good. You know, I like, you know, it's sort of the whole Marvel thing all over again. I like when, you know, something is not just a simple, well, we banged out a script that'll play out in 42 minutes and, you know, we'll never think about it again. You know, there's something cool about having those elements that, you know, carry over and continue through. But it's also problematic if you're not necessarily able to, you know, devote the resources to just keeping up with it. So,
yeah, I think Doctor Who in general is pretty good about that kind of thing. I mean, yes, there are episodes which definitely link up with each other, but I would say most of them, I mean, certainly over half of them, you can just watch as a standalone episode. I mean, obviously there's going to be context you're going to miss.
Sure.
For if you just sort of pop in and out. But I mean, Blink, for example, that's completely watchable on, as its own entity.
Okay.
I mean, there's no continuity at all. From memory, there's no continuity at all. So, yeah, I mean, and there are other episodes where you can definitely just sort of say, yeah, watch this and then move on. But, yeah, I mean, it's something that I love. I mean, I've loved it since I was a kid. It's been almost a lifelong passion of mine.
Well, it's been around long enough to be that. What was the break? How long between when the original run of Doctor Who ended and the new one started? What was the time frame there? Like 20 years?
It was cancelled in 1989.
Okay.
And it came back in 2005.
So about 16 years then.
16 years, yeah.
That's a long time.
Yeah.
But it's been interesting to see it come back and not only be successful and find its fan base, but man, it's bigger now than it ever was. It's huge. At least it seems that way to me.
Yeah,
maybe. I guess I can't compare the original one because it was the original one was way more popular in the UK than it was here in the US. To watch it in the US,
that's the thing.
Yeah,
since it's come back, it's broken America. And
yeah,
that was always something that Doctor Who struggled with. So
yeah,
if nothing else, it's been a huge success.
The original Doctor Who ran mostly, if not exclusively, on PBS stations in America, and I saw it on WTTW out of Chicago. And, you know, but I'm imagining that a lot of the smaller markets, it never even made it there. And certainly there probably weren't, none of the big, you know, certainly none of the big TV networks were carrying it. So this has just been a whole new experience. And I do think a lot of people in America found Doctor Who for the first time through this new version of the series, again, here in America. So, well, Colin, we have talked for, you know, we're approaching 2 hours, and certainly that's a good enough time, I think. You know, I hit all the points I had hoped to. Was there anything that you wanted to discuss? We had a short pre-show conversation, and I asked you that question. You basically said no, but has anything come up since?
Not really. I think everything that's been going on recently has come up through conversation. So, yeah, I'm good.
All right. Well, real quickly here, let our audience know where they can, you know, find your show and keep up with the stuff you're doing.
Yeah, my music/personal blog podcast is ouroboros.co.uk, which is ouroboros.co.uk. My film review show, Raw Footage, where I record my reviews as soon as I come out of the cinema screen on my portable recorder. So it's a stream of consciousness film review show. That's at raw-footage.co.uk. And if you want to follow me on Twitter, it's ouroboros54, which is ouroboros54.
All right, and we'll link to your websites in our show notes. And just for, you know, to make it easy, you can just go to hypernonsense.com/Colin, C-O-L-I-N. That'll take you right to this episode, and you'll be able to see, you know, all the links there. And, you know, anything we mentioned, like some of the blog posts we talked about earlier, we'll link to those as well. So thank you, Colin, not only for being my guest, but my guest co-host. And before I end the show, well, I'll mention this in the outro. So thanks, Colin. It was great to talk to you again. And I have a feeling if you're up to it, we may have you on again in the future. So
yeah, we'll have to work out some schedules.
Yeah, indeed. So, Colin, I want you to hold on the line for a second. I'm going to mute you on my end while I do the usual outro, but don't hang up just yet.
Okay.
So, let me hit this button over here and make sure that I hit the right buttons everywhere else. I think I did. All right. And play. Here we go. We do it live. Ooh, I can still hear Colin. Now I think I've muted him. We'll find out in a second. Anyway, thanks again, Colin, for joining me today. This has been fun. You can find us on the internet at hypernonsense.com, and you can follow us on Twitter at hypernonsense. You can send us an email, show@hypernonsense.com. You can call our revived voicemail line from your telephone unit of choice. That's area code 805-725-5085. What's cool about our phone number is, with the exception of that pesky 7 in there, all the numbers line up. You don't believe me? Take a look at it. Look at it on your telephone keypad. So, we do have one voicemail, which we will play soon. So the line has been rebroken in, rechristened, if you will, but we'd still love to hear from you. If you have any thoughts on the 50 Shades of Grey, or anything else we talked about on this show or any past shows, or you just want to call in and go, "Hi, Hypernonsense, you suck," we'll take that. We'd love some iTunes reviews, hypernonsense.com/iTunes. They'll shoot you straight over to our listing and let us know what you think of the show. Good or bad, we want all the thoughts. And I'm going to officially announce this now, though we kind of alluded to it a little bit earlier. We're going to put together a roster, if you will, of on-the-fly co-hosts, just to kind of fill in until Jen can be back 100%. And don't worry, Jen will be back. She's still here. She's not going anywhere. Don't unsubscribe if you only listen for Jen or you listen mostly for her. And if you do, I totally understand. But I promise you she'll be back. But if you're out there in the world and you got a Skype or a FaceTime or a tin cup with a string on the end and you'd like to maybe fill in sometimes for us on the show, be a guest co-host, send an email, send a tweet, do a thing, and let us know, and we'll put you on the list. And who knows, maybe you'll get all the fortune and glory that comes with being a co-host of Hypernonsense. And I've said enough. Thank you so much for listening. With any luck, some combination of us will be back next week. Fat Wabs. Give me some Fat Wabs. Put some butter, put some cheese and toast on those Wabs.
Hello, welcome to Skype call testing service. After the beep, please record a message. Afterwards, your message will be played back to you.
Skype lady, let's test some game. Skype lady, don't you be no pain. Skype lady, let's go to a show. Skype lady, let's test some game. Skype lady, don't you be no pain. Skype lady, let's go to a show.
If you are able to hear your own voice, then you have configured Skype correctly. If you hear this message, but not your own voice, then something is wrong with your audio recording settings. Please check your microphone and microphone settings or
No. My microphone and microphone settings are fine.